You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a new move in the U.S. Senate could halt the multi-billion dollar arms deal the Trump administration reached with Saudi Arabia. We'll learn what's at stake coming up. First, last week's Apple Developers Conference marked the beginning of the end of a digital era. The company announced it's going to end iTunes 18 years after the software debuted. Here's a listen to late Apple chairman Steve Jobs speaking in January of 2001, introducing iTunes, something he called a music revolution.
Really clean, really simple, far more powerful. It allows you to have libraries of music. It allows you to rip CDs. It allows you to create playlists. And it allows you to burn CDs all in one integrated application, all in one window. And let me show this to you now.
iTunes grew well beyond those original abilities, wrapping in the iTunes Store, video and podcast options, and compatibility with the iPod. All of that could make the program pretty frustrating to use, but it left a big impact on the way many of us buy and listen to music. Alyssa Breznak is a staff writer covering technology and culture for The Ringer. Alyssa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess people in the know didn't see this as a big, huge surprise that iTunes is going away. Why is it, though, finally being phased out?
I think the basic answer is that it just got really bloated. It was a catch-all for so many different functions within the Apple ecosystem. And, you know, it was just cumbersome to open up. It would freeze computers. People would get lost in their music libraries. They would end up in the Apple Music Store. It just got really confusing. So that was kind of what motivated Apple, which always aims for simplicity, to move away from that model.
Yeah, it seems like it was simultaneously the most used and most hated software, the combination of the two together that you don't always see. There's a love-hate relationship with iTunes over the years.
Definitely. Like, we had to live with it, and it would pop up at times that were so inconvenient for users. I think over the past maybe like 5 years, every time I've plugged in my phone to like a car radio, iTunes has popped up and played the very first song on my library playlist, and it's so annoying.
Can I ask what song it is?
Oh, it's whatever starts with an A. I don't even remember.
Okay.
It's something completely thrown away, but it's because it's alphabetical. It's just a tick within the system. It's just one of the many quirks of iTunes.
I think everybody, whatever generation you're in, has nostalgic memories of whatever form of technology we listen to music on, whether it's the iPod or CDs or albums or, I don't know, wax cylinders. You were in a sweet spot for iTunes, right?
Yeah, so I was a teen right when iTunes came out in 2001, and I was on my family computers. I was on my family computer stealing music from Napster, essentially.
Uh-oh.
And so I needed a place to put it, and iTunes was that place. And I was ripping, mixing, burning CDs, as the Apple advertisement goes, rip, mix, burn. So that was what I was doing. And if I wasn't getting my music from Napster, it would either be the CD store or from my parents' CD collection.
But there, one big development of iTunes is it gave a legal way to get music online without having to go to sometimes sketchy online sites.
Yeah, and that was in 2003. So that was a big gap between when it first came out, when the iPod came out, and then when the Apple Music Store was introduced. And so that was a time when, you know, eventually Napster was shut down because it was illegal, and other peer-to-peer file sharing networks popped up in its place. But if you're a teen with nothing to do in the middle of the day and you have all this access to free music on the internet, you're going to learn how to do it that way. And I think from then on, I didn't really quite understand the concept of paying for songs or CDs. That was very foreign to me.
Talking to Alyssa Breznak from The Ringer, talking about the end of iTunes. Apple says iTunes is going away. Alyssa, before you go any further, some people, I think, are a little panicked by this. People who have their entire music collections on iTunes, are people going to be able to keep their stuff?
Yes, there is no need to panic. I think that would cause a riot if Apple just decided that no one owned their media anymore. It's going to be splitting into three separate apps. One is music, the other is playlists, and then TV. And so all of your music is going to go to the music app, and all of your podcasts are going to go to the podcast app. And finally, all of your media, your TV shows will go on the TV app. It's going to be really seamless. And that'll happen in the fall when Apple releases its most recent Mac OS update.
What is Apple's strategy here in not just ending iTunes, but replacing it with three different threads, as you just mentioned?
They just want to clean things up, I think. And, you know, this is also just a shift away from a previous model. Initially, Steve Jobs really hammered in the idea that people should own their own media. It was media ownership. And hard drives got really big and crowded because of that. But at the same time, Apple's devices were getting smaller and smaller and thinner and thinner. So eventually those two things sort of, you know, went up against each other, and it became incompatible. So they had to move to this cloud-based system. That's where the industry was going. And that's why eventually it just made more sense to split these up in three, and everyone have their own libraries in the cloud in each one.
You wrote a piece about this, looking at the industry news, but also kind of your personal memories. We've talked some about that. Did you ever have a phase of having a lot of music on a physical medium, a CD or other format like that?
Yeah, but most of the memory I have is making the playlist on iTunes and then burning them onto CDs. So it was a way that I interacted with it, but it wasn't like a record or anything. I got to decide what was on the CD. It was very rarely just an album of an artist's work.
And do you feel like there's going to be a big generational divide for, you know, people who grew up the way you did in the early days of iTunes, and people who, you know, iTunes is already passé as they came into their musical lives?
Sure. I mean, I think I wrote in my piece that this is kind of like the 8-track for some people. You know, it was a necessary piece of technology that bridged two eras of listening. So obviously kids these days have no nostalgia or need for iTunes. They've probably been using streaming services most of their lives. But that doesn't mean that these things didn't have value for us. And, you know, in the same way, I remember, you know, my elders at the time would say, kids who download MP3s don't have any value for the music or the artists, or they don't appreciate, or they're not engaged. And I would say that actually iTunes and the like, sort of data entry that I had to do when I was using it actually kept me very engaged. So I'm sure there's going to be a version of that for a younger generation too. And I think that like by investing that kind of time, that's how you really engage with an artist and feel like, oh, okay, I'm their fan.
We heard from Keith on Facebook, who says, I buy my music usually on CD. If I really like it, I get it on record too. If I love it, I'll buy a download on Amazon. Keith says, artists put a lot of work in their craft. The least we can do is support them by buying their work. One complicated part of the story with iTunes, with streaming, and I assume with whatever replaces them, is how artists get compensated. Have we seen controversy with that on iTunes in particular?
I mean, definitely. iTunes kind of rocked the entertainment industry, the music industry, when it was first released in 2003. You know, before that, people were making a lot of money from CDs, and the idea that people could just buy a single song, like maybe the most popular song on an album, really threatened a huge source of income for artists. And we've only seen that kind of thing increase as streaming services have sort of gotten the rights to albums, and artists are given fractions of a cent for a listen instead of, you know, someone purchasing an actual song. So it's become a lot more ephemeral for the artists, and it's definitely true that they suffer for it.
We're talking to Alyssa Breznak, technology and culture writer for The Ringer, about the end of Apple's iTunes. The company says it's going away, going to be replaced by three different programs. Alyssa, has there been anything really that competes with iTunes? I know there was Windows Media Player, but I have a Windows computer and I used iTunes on Windows instead.
I think the competitors ended up coming up as streaming services ultimately. I mean, definitely not from the beginning. Yes, there was like Winamp and as you mentioned, the Windows Player. But for the most part, I would say the competitors were Pandora, Spotify, eventually Netflix, because the services started to really center around the content itself as opposed to being a platform. as we move to sort of a cloud streaming model as opposed to an ownership model.
Want to go to our callers now. Samantha is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Samantha, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your story, Samantha?
Well, I have downloaded music onto my phone frequently, and every time I do where I get, I just have enough music that I love, something happens to the device or something crashes it and I lose all my music. So I just started buying CDs and I'm listening to those. I know it's very old school and I'm an older person, but honestly, at least I always know I have my music.
Samantha, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, there's something about our psychological attachment to that physical CD versus something we feel like we might lose, even if we can reload and rebuild it, Alyssa.
Yeah, I think so. And it just goes back to the we want the kind of music we listened to when we were growing up. I think that's a formative time for us. I know so many people who love to listen to records when they were younger, and that's just going to be the main media that they're going to use for the rest of their life. I think that's really special about music, and I think everyone should do like their own way for sure.
Samantha, thanks for the call. But then there's me. I grew up with vinyl and cassettes, and I don't have a turntable. I do not have a cassette player. I don't see myself ever going back unless there's some kind of midlife crisis in the offing. A lot of people do seem to make this transition okay.
It's very modern of you, I would say. Yeah, I think it depends on whether or not you're into technology and you want to adapt. But I don't think that there's any sort of judgment call. I think it's what's convenient to you, just as long as you know the tools that are available.
Thanks a lot for that call, Samantha, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Jason now in Monroe. Jason, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Oh, yeah, I'm an artist myself. I mean, and when I say artist, I mean like crossing different boundaries, drawing, painting, sculpting, and music. So as an artist, I feel with my whole heart that Apple kind of, in my opinion, destroyed this thing we call music. They kind of manipulate it into a virtual, intangible, but tangible kind of thing. And, it devastated everything from the way, like, an artist was getting paid. It devastated everything to the way we were consuming it. And, I've reverted back to collecting vinyl myself. I have a turntable. It's awesome. It's a really clear, you know, I think the artist's way of enjoying the music. And I think iTunes, and it's very, like, I would say, not so user-friendly ways of going about, like, if I had a file in, you know, my hard drive, if I moved it, Apple wouldn't know where it is now. You know, and I'm like, well, we're in the year 2000, whatever, and the software can't figure out where my music is now, and I moved it. Yeah, I physically moved it, but the fact that, like, the program can't figure out where that you know, file is, and I can just simply search it in my search bar, I felt that it was very, like, I don't know, like, it was a great idea, just not very well thought out to, you know, the whole idea of if you moved that piece of data.
Gotcha. So, like, Jason, thanks a lot for the call. We got a couple things there to work with. Alyssa, first of all, as a musician, he's not wild about it. I'm guessing Jason probably isn't the only musician in the world who feels like he does.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such an important, I think, issue for artists. They, you know, in the past couple of years, there's been major artists who have stood up for more indie artists. And Taylor Swift is one of them who said, hey, you know, you need to, like, Spotify, you need to treat indie artists better, and you can't take advantage of them like this. And so, yeah, I mean, it's really tough because it was a time of lawlessness in the initial internet. Everyone who was a teen was using Napster, and the moral argument didn't really work there. Once it's available, people are going to use it. And nowadays, because we have streaming and because iTunes sort of you know, showed us the way there, it's gotten worse and worse. And I really do think eventually it will come to a type of head with the music industry where artists are banding together to ask for more.
And Jason talked about some of the cumbersome nature of iTunes. If you did something tricky like move a music file to a different folder, it could really stymie iTunes. I think I've encountered that myself. Have you, Alyssa?
Yeah, I've lost so much music because iTunes is so disorganized. I mean, it's kind of amazing that, you know, Apple's whole thing is that this is supposed to be very user intuitive. They've always made a big deal about having great relationships with artists, and it's always been featured in their advertising and media so prominently. And yet, just like the simple experience of, okay, find me my music. Can you identify the MP3s on my hard drive? I guess not.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jason, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Alyssa Bresnak from The Ringer about the end of Apple's iTunes. They're phasing it out, replacing it with different programs, breaking it up into music and video and podcast platforms. Back to your calls now. We've got Mark with us in Madison. Mark, hi.
Hello. How are you doing? It's a good subject. I'm 57 years old. I've been playing music since I was a child, all kinds of instruments. Had some CD recordings under my belt in the studio, and I could not tell you how to download anything. I support my musicians that I listen to, all the music. I buy their CDs. I buy their T-shirts because that's what they want you to do from the very beginning, so that's what I do.
And is there something special about having the CD and the liner notes and all that stuff for you, Mark?
Absolutely, yes. You look at who was on there. Might have been a guest musician. What studio they recorded? Who actually did the engineering, the mixing, and all that? That's interesting stuff. And then the artwork too, you know. And that's just makes it interesting. You're sitting there with a beer and you're listening to the music and reading everything that's on the CD cover and the book that comes along with it.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Alyssa, I got to admit, I thought I was going to be like Mark at one stage in my life. And then, man, CDs and albums sure take up a lot of space. And I gradually eased over to being willing to buy the digital version without all the liner notes and things like that. But then for a lot of people after a certain generation, Alyssa, I guess, what's a liner note?
Yeah, it's funny that he said that, and that sounds very nostalgic, and I really appreciate his relationship with artists in that way. But I do think that there are new ways to engage with artists that sort of go beyond the liner note. It's like maybe you won't read that in the pamphlet of a CD or the inside of an album cover, but you'll see it on their Twitter, or it's part of a merchandise package you buy when you buy concerts for the ticket or tickets for a concert. So I think that what he's talking about has sort of been integrated into a larger social media platform that each artist has to keep maintained now. And the liner notes might not necessarily be in paper form, but we're getting that extra information from Twitter and from Instagram and from these artists' websites that they're running.
Thanks a lot for that call. Alyssa, one, I think, highlight, and you touched on this in iTunes, is the playlist. Before that, we could make mixtapes on cassettes for people, carefully curating and hitting the record button at just the right time. Do you still make playlists, mix lists for people?
I do, actually. And in fact, I really enjoy Spotify's social playlist maker, which means you can like add other people on and they can collaborate on a playlist. That's one really nice thing about these cloud-based streaming platforms is that they are far more social and you can see what your friends are listening to and send them songs. And I would say that the playlist is still really important to me. I think we associate music with moods and different emotions in our life. And when you have the right playlist, like say you're on the beach and you're looking at the sunset and you're cracking open a beer, you want to have a nice playlist for that. You might not want a whole album. And that's what's really great about this whole digital revolution in the first place. It's really made it so that we can customize this music to our lives.
So we got this big change in the works with iTunes now. Alyssa, what are you watching for? What are the frontiers of music consumption that you're watching to see where they're going to go?
Actually, I'm very interested in the social media network TikTok. It's an app. And it's where a lot of teens are spending their time nowadays. And it's also where they're discovering new artists. You may famously know Lil Nas X, who sang Old Town Road, and that's still number one on the Billboard charts. But that started with a viral Vine challenge. And I think that young people are engaging with music in the form of doing challenges. And that's their way. That's their bonding with the artist. You know, they have a memory of doing something, just like I had a memory of like metadata entry into my iTunes. So that's what I'm looking at.
We'll leave it there for now, Alyssa. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Alyssa Bresnak. She's a staff writer covering technology and culture for The Ringer. She was with us to talk about the legacy of iTunes after Apple announced it's phasing out the software. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the demise of iTunes later this year and tell us how you like to listen to music, whether digitally, streaming, or in some kind of physical medium, vinyl or CD or cassette. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, it's the big show for women's soccer at the 2019 World Cup in France. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the latest from the big event, the prospects for the U.S. team, and the future of women's soccer. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a multi-billion dollar arms deal agreed upon by the Trump administration and Saudi Arabia could be stalled due to a bipartisan move in the U.S. Senate. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut and Republican Senator Todd Young of Indiana are requesting a report from the administration on Saudi Arabia's human rights record. The move could trigger a vote in Congress to halt the agreement, which has been largely unpopular with lawmakers in both parties and both chambers. Another bipartisan duo is working on another piece of legislation that could block the deal. Our next guest is here to talk about the arms agreement, how Congress might block the sale, and how it could all impact U.S. diplomatic relations in the Middle East. Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near Eastern and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back, Rob.
Can you talk about what's at stake with this arms deal, the U.S. allowing arms to be sold and selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates?
Well, the current deal involves an $8 billion package, which is not only to export weapons to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, but it is also within that going to allow Raytheon, a defense contractor, to in fact build bomb parts in Saudi Arabia, ostensibly for use in the now four-year-old Yemen war. This is going to include control systems, guidance, electronics, and circuit boards. So we're talking about some very, very sophisticated technology, which now is going to be shared and is going to, in fact, be manufactured in Saudi Arabia. So that seems to be rather unprecedented. The other unprecedented element of this is the Trump administration's declaration that this is a national emergency. And that allows the administration to circumvent what otherwise would be congressional authorization pursuant to the weapons export law. So we have a rather wide definition and interpretation of what constitutes an emergency in the national security interest that's being invoked by the Trump administration in order to circumvent the Congress's otherwise authorized duty to serve as a check and balance on what is increasingly becoming a unilateral action on American foreign policy by the White House.
The U.S. has a long history of supplying various kinds of military aid and technology to Saudi Arabia without a lot of pushback, I think, in Congress in particular. Why are we seeing such pushback now?
Well, there has been pushback in the past, but we have to go quite a ways back. In the early 1980s, Congress, in fact, did push back on the White House at the time, efforts to sell the Saudis advanced reconnaissance and air surveillance aircraft, the AWACS system. Similarly, there were efforts to block the sale of advanced fighter jets to Saudi Arabia. Things have changed dramatically, particularly over the last two administrations, for two reasons. One is an increasingly antagonistic posture that the United States has toward Iran and the region, as well as the fact that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are both willing and very able customers for American weapon systems.
Talk to Saeed Khan from Wayne State University over U.S. arms deals with Saudi Arabia and latest efforts in Congress to potentially block one of the newest deals. Talk about the role of Yemen and the war in Yemen in this conversation, Saeed.
Well, in many ways, Rob, Yemen has become very much the 21st century version of the Spanish Civil War, where we really have mostly proxies that are engaged in that conflict. And in this case, it's primarily Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on one side and Iran on the other. What is unique in this situation compared to the Spanish Civil War is that the United States has gone all in on the side of what we probably call the fascists, those who seek to go ahead and establish for themselves a by all means necessary resolution to push back on Iran and send a message to their neighbor in the region that they are going to dominate when it comes to the geopolitics of the region.
How much of a role does U.S. military aid play directly in Yemen? How much of the weapons we are providing directly or indirectly are being used in, say, bombing campaigns in Yemen?
Almost 100%, Rob, because after all, the Saudis and the UAE do not manufacture weapons of their own, with the exception of maybe some small munitions that they buy from elsewhere. When it comes to the precision-guided bombs that are supplied by the United States by way of Raytheon, as well as the delivery systems, they are all U.S. fighter jets and bombers that are involved in that process, as well as any missile payload that is being employed and deployed.
Apart from Yemen, a lot of people in Congress are raising the issue of the role of Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, often called MBS, and his suspected role related to the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi last year, and what many senators are saying, well, we haven't heard enough from Saudi Arabia about what happened there. How much is that the death, the killing of Khashoggi, still affecting Congress?
I think it demonstrates what the Trump administration's posture is toward not just Saudi Arabia, but toward MBS, Mohammed bin Salman himself, as well as his counterpart in the United Arab Emirates, MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed. These two relatively young individuals are essentially the focus of America placing all of its eggs in their proverbial basket in order to look at the future of the region and, in the case of the United States, an ability to exert influence at the expense and really to the exception of anybody else, including China and Russia. Now, when it comes to the Khashoggi matter, it's important to remember that President Trump had a tepid at best response to what had happened. There is still, from his public pronouncements, skepticism that he has, even against his own intelligence agencies, that MBS had anything to do with the authorization of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi last October in Istanbul, Turkey. At the same time, the president had also mentioned, and I think now it's becoming even more resonant as to what is at the very core of the White House's policy towards Saudi Arabia, that Saudi Arabia is a very good customer when it comes to buying American weapon systems. So it really does seem to be the economics, but also what is lurking in the background is whether this is just about what is beneficial to American defense companies, or is there some kind of personal gain to be achieved by the Trump family?
We're talking to Saeed Khan right now, senior lecturer in Near Eastern and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. He's with us to talk about the latest news about a U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, how that deal could hit a snag due to bipartisan efforts in the U.S. Senate. Saeed, we left that hanging there. You raised the question of possible personal gain for the Trump family in dealings with Saudi Arabia. What are you referring to?
Well, most recently, there was an article in The Guardian out of the U.K., it talks about Jared Kushner, the first son-in-law, who has a $50 million stake in an investment firm called Cadre, which seems to have mysteriously received about $90 million of cash infusion from unknown and foreign sources, including $1 million from Saudi Arabia. There was also, as we remember, back in 2017, when President Trump's first overseas trip was in fact to Saudi Arabia. And shortly after his convening there, there was a pledge by both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to donate $100 million to a World Bank fund, which was inspired by first daughter Ivanka Trump. So it still remains a bit nebulous as to whether there is personal gain to be made for the Trump Corporation, as well as its various entities and family members.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. If I'm not happy with them selling arms, I'm not happy with us selling arms to anybody, really. But the concern is if we're not going to be the ones doing it, they're going to go somewhere else and get it. And then you're going to contend with either Russia or China. supplying arms, and then they're going to get their foothold into the region even further. And then that's some issues that we're going to have to deal with down the line. So geopolitically, we're kind of like, you know, up against the wall. We don't like it, but, you know, the enemies of my enemy is my friend kind of thing.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. This is a concern that others have raised, Saeed, that if they don't buy weapons from us, other, even maybe less savory actors will step in.
Well, I think that Jeremy makes a very important point. I'm not sure how much less savory one can get than profiting off the misery of Yemen. But taking that as a point, I think that that is a train that has already left the proverbial station, and it is causing a further entrenchment within the region of some of the powers that represent a far greater threat to the United States than even what is declared as Iran. We find that Iran and now even a NATO ally like Turkey are being pushed into the side of the ledger that includes China and Russia. Just recently, of course, Turkey has decided to purchase some advanced missile systems from Russia, the S-400. There has been a threat by the United States that if it were to do so, that the U.S. would withhold the delivery of advanced fighter jets, the F-35. President Recep Erdogan of Turkey has called the bluff and said that he, in fact, is looking to shop around to China and Russia when it comes to their advanced weapon systems. Now, this is quite unprecedented because, as I mentioned, Turkey has been a solid NATO ally. The idea of being upset at Turkey for buying Russian weapons is actually not that hypocritical. Greece and Bulgaria, two other NATO countries, have already done so without facing such a threat from the United States. Iran, of course, has a very good relationship with China. And moving forward, these countries are going to be vitally and strategically critical, given the fact that China is resurrecting the Silk Road, the so-called Belt and Road Initiative, that will go through Iran and Turkey. And as a result of it, the geostrategic decision by the United States to favor Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, two countries who are, in the grand scheme of things, really insignificant, and certainly their human rights records and their political alignment are not exactly congruent with American values, it seems like a rather peculiar foreign policy decision at this time.
Thanks for the call. We'll bring on Heather now in Madison. Heather, hi. Excuse me, Heather, hello.
Hi, I just think your last comment is really on the mark. It's a really difficult situation. There's lots of chess pieces on the board that are moving in different ways, and this is a little bit of our own making, given our tight relationship with the Saudis and their record. You know, historically, we've had kind of turned a blind eye to that situation, and I think it might be coming back to bite us in the butt. That's it.
Heather, thanks for the call. Saeed, what do you have to say to Heather?
I don't think I can improve on Heather's eloquence in assessing the situation. I think this idea of the chickens coming home to roost has definitely occurred. And I know that this is going to sound like a bit of Monday morning armchair quarterbacking, but we can see in the not-so-distant past what really was the linchpin that caused this to unravel. And it was the rather ill-judged invasion of Iraq, which really then dismantled what was a very delicate and precarious stability, relatively speaking, in the Middle East. Now, how does the United States come back from that? Where and how does it then exert and assert still a considerable amount of power, both militarily and financially, remains to be seen.
In our last couple minutes, Saeed, what do you make of this effort in Congress to at least try and assert some control over this kind of arms deal?
Well, I think there's three major takeaways from this. First of all, it's a bipartisan effort. Senator Todd Young, Republican from Indiana, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut. I think that the optics are very good because it's showing that both sides of the aisle are finally coming together on some issue. The second thing that it also demonstrates is the effort made by Congress to try to take back some of its authority from what has been seen as really a categorical and a unilateral expression, and some would even argue abuse of power by the executive branch. And thirdly, the idea of the United States reasserting itself, at least from the congressional side, with an effort to engage in a foreign policy that brings a kind of balance and perhaps even a restoration to the guidance that America has provided in the region, and particularly signaling itself to some of its more traditional allies in the West.
And briefly, Saeed, do you see this emerging as maybe an issue in the presidential campaign?
It's difficult to say because there are so many issues that tend to have much more resonance when it comes to the American electorate. Of course, abortion, the U.S. Supreme Court, the economy. These are, of course, going to take up most of the oxygen in the debate. Foreign policy is usually seen as a subordinate issue. But if it's raised as a matter of a question, perhaps even a referendum or an indictment on the judgment of the White House, then it could certainly have some traction if it is framed appropriately and accurately by various candidates.
Saeed, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Saeed Khan, senior lecturer in Near Eastern and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. He joined us today to talk about a bipartisan effort in the U.S. Senate aimed at blocking the Trump administration's multi-billion-dollar arms sale to Saudi Arabia. It's time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about siblings.
Earlier this year, I started working with students at Monona Grove Liberal Arts Charter School, or MG21. The goal was to get more high school students' stories on the airwaves. When I first showed up in the classroom, there was one student who seemed to be particularly interested in creating radio and interviewing people.
Like, I'm always that person that I always keep, like, asking questions. Like, it's uncomfortable for me to be quiet and uncomfortable for me to not have a conversation, so my brain is always running.
Junior Sierra Reederer had like 4 story ideas on day one, which is impressive. Stories about school lockdowns and charter schools. Ultimately, Sierra decided to work on a story about her brother, 13-year-old Thomas. I went to her house one night as Sierra was teaching Thomas how to play pool.
Want to grab your stick, bub?
Yes.
Oh, shoot.
What other games do you like to play?
We like playing Minecraft.
Minecraft!
Do you like watching movies?
Yeah!
What's your favorite thing to eat?
Gosh, your fried root beer.
Grilled cheese, fries, and what?
Root beer.
I decided to do my brother because I love him. My brother has Down syndrome and how that affects like our family and how he's not really different from like anyone else. But at the same time, he is. I don't know. My brother's just an interesting person. So I was like, why not do the interesting person in my life?
Sierra then went on to interview her mom and grandma about Thomas. Let's listen to parts of those conversations.
I'm Sierra Reeder, and I'm here sitting with Shirley Drew and my grandma at her house in her kitchen. And we're going to talk about my little brother Thomas and how his Down syndrome has affected him or not affected him, and just a little bit about him. So, to start off, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Great, okay. Do you remember the feelings you had when you were told that Thomas had Down syndrome?
I probably didn't have any real feelings. I just thought, okay, what can we do for him to make his life better?
What are some of the best memories that you've had with Thomas?
When we're in the car and he puts in the CD, and right now, today, it's Johnny Mathis, a Christmas CD.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
And we sing these songs each time he gets in the car, 365 days out of the year. I love it.
Why do you love Thomas so much?
He's made my life fuller, and he's never angry. Doesn't matter what, generally he does not hold a grudge. For that reason alone, I love him.
I'm Sierra Reeder, and I'm here with my mom, Michelle Reeder, in our office, and I'm going to interview her about some questions about my little brother, Thomas. Why do you love Thomas so much? Besides from the fact that he's your own kid.
You know, he just brings another spin on life. you know, when you're not having those good days, then he kind of can turn it around sometimes.
What challenges come with having a child with Down syndrome? Sorry, I didn't mean to make you cry.
Not knowing what the future holds for him. You know, making sure everything is in place, you know, when he gets to be to the point of independence. So when the day comes that we're not here anymore, he can still navigate the world.
I told him if he ever wants to come live with me, he has me.
That was MG21 Junior Sierra Reederer talking with her family about her brother Thomas. To hear her full interviews, check out our upcoming hour-long special, Classroom Frequency, Student Stories from Wisconsin, or visit wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You can hear Classroom Frequency, Student Voices from Wisconsin, coming up tonight at 6 right here on the Ideas Network. More on that story and stories about things like music, a student's interest in military history, and an intriguing story about a bunny. Check it all out on Classroom Frequency, Student Voices from Wisconsin. Here, Maureen McCollum and the students at that high school, Monona Grove. That's tonight at 6 here on the Ideas Network.